Well, you've heard of Nostradamus, of course, on this program, Edgar Cayce, Gene Dixon, psychic. But what about the past? Past prophecy. In a moment, our special guest, L.A. Marzulli, politics, prophecy, and the supernatural on Coast to Coast AM. L.A. Marzulli, best-selling author of the Nephilim Trilogy, receiving an honorary doctorate for his work on the Nephilim. His new nonfiction book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, The Coming Great Deception, and the Luciferian Endgame, may connect some dots that others have overlooked. And he possesses an in-depth knowledge of UFOs and other supernatural phenomena. He is our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Lynn, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great, George. Thanks for having me back again.
It's been a while, my friend.
It certainly has.
Hey, good work here.
Thank you.
Good work here indeed. You know,
appreciate
that. Luciferian Endgame, what's happening?
Well, you just jump right into it.
Oh, man, let me tell you. That's scary.
Yeah, it is scary. I mean, if it's to get there, we've got to connect some dots kind of before we jump into the last hurrah, as it were. But basically, if there's an entity by the name of Lucifer, and of course I believe that there is, this guy is just like a super scientist. He's not a guy in a red suit running around with a pitchfork like so many movies and comics.
Yeah.
And, you know, this guy is like he's incredibly intelligent. Probably a super scientist in the sense that if we're able to manipulate DNA, and we are, right, we've just accessed that in the last 40 or 50 years. What if this guy was able to access that DNA thousands and thousands of years ago? What if by accessing some of that DNA, let's say, you know, we've in previous shows we've discussed the Nephilim, the giants, the whole idea of fallen angels,
mm-hmm.
mating with the women of Earth and the offspring being in the Nephilim. But what if they messed around genetically and some of the Greek mythos, like the Centaur, the Minotaur, that type of a thing? What if that type of genetic manipulation is actually happening right now? And what if some of that is going to, for instance, let me skip forward. The Book of Revelation paints a portrait of these creatures coming out of this, what it calls the abuso, the abyss.
Yes.
Abuso in Greek, abyss in English. And whatever these creatures are, I mean, they are just bizarre. Hair like a woman, face, you know, teeth like a lion, tails like a scorpion. I mean, this guy who's looking at this, John on the Isle of Patmos, is seeing this vision. He's describing it as best he can. Now, some people will look at that and say, well, how can that possibly be literal? And I believe that it just may be literal. And the reason for that is I once had an interview with a guy from Amgen. Amgen they basically work in genetics. That's what they do. And it's pretty much a national company, and it's cutting-edge stuff. And this guy was like, you know, he had access to certain things. But what blew me away is when he discussed the fact that they took the DNA of a firefly and crossed it with a frog, and the frog would light up, basically glow in the dark. Now, that's just what he knows.
Yeah.
Okay? That's what he told me. Think of, you know, what might be happening in some of these underground labs. Think of the combinations that may be occurring. And, of course, you know, we're not going to know about them. And maybe in the United States they're not, but what about other countries that have access to this? So getting back to your question of a Luciferian endgame, I think that when this thing finally manifests, when he finally kind of, it's like full disclosure, this is what it is. And, of course, we're leaping towards the end of the story without, you know, connecting some.
This is like a flashback in a movie, because then we're going to go back to what really happened.
There you go. I think when it comes with all lying wonders and total deception. I think that most people on the planet will look at this thing and embrace it. I think it will happen after some sort of a incredible, probably a nuclear holocaust somewhere on the Earth, more than likely in the Middle East. That's where I would pinpoint it. And at that point, I think it's full disclosure. I think it's full alien disclosure. In other words, it's kind of like the Independence Day scenario where UFOs are over the cities of the world.
Right.
A couple of weeks ago, you know, that mile-wide UFO was seen, spotted in the English Channel by two different pilots and two different airplanes.
And then later on, another large object or objects spotted over the United Kingdom in another region.
There you go. And to me, it's ramping up. To me, it's like they're getting bolder. I mean, if this thing was a mile wide, I mean, can you imagine waking up one morning, turning on CNN or Fox News or whatever, and there above the city of Los Angeles or Jerusalem or Paris or wherever.
Or all of them.
Or all of them simultaneously are these craft. Everybody's worldview is instantly changed. Instantly changed. And unless, I mean, I believe that this whole thing is ramping up and into a deception. And the new book, Politics, Prophecy, the Supernatural, Luciferian Endgame, I get there, you know, step by step by step as to why I think this is where it's headed. It's kind of like peaking to that. I believe all the signs are there. And I think when this war, this nuclear exchange happens, more than likely in the Middle East, that's the trigger, the supernatural trigger, which these guys will then manifest.
You've got some heavy hitters who have written comments on the back of your book. And what I noticed, which was clever and also surprising, is the other heavy hitter was you. So I'm going to read it, because on the back of your book is your quote, and it says, the present political landscape is in direct correlation to supernatural events that happened, in some cases, millennia ago. What do you mean by that?
Okay, that's a mouthful, and I'm going to repeat it one more time because it goes by so quick, and I know when I first thought on it, I wrote it down and just stared at it for about 5 minutes. The present political landscape is in direct correlation to supernatural events that happened, in some cases, millennia ago. And, of course, what I mean by this is that here in the United States, and here's just a real simple example that we can take a look at and everybody agrees, we celebrate Christmas. It's a national holiday. What are we celebrating? Whether you believe or not believe is beside the point. You're celebrating a supernatural event that happened roughly 2,000 years ago. You're celebrating the supposed virgin birth of this guy Jesus. Now, whether it's true or not, I mean, that's for, you know, you guys to decide.
Sure.
But that's, nonetheless, you know, this culture, the American culture, is steeped in supernatural events. Let me give you another one. A couple of months later, we celebrate the same guy Jesus' resurrection. I mean, how much more supernatural and bizarre do you want to get? And those are just two. The Israelis, the Jews in Israel, believe in supernatural events. Some of those supernatural events are Moses parting the Red Sea, the Ten Commandments being given to Moses, the Ten Plagues of Egypt, the Passover, which is roughly 4,000 years old, is still celebrated today. What happened then? The angel of death passed over the firstborn of the Israelis and killed the Egyptians, which caused Pharaoh to let them go. Now, either it's clever mythos, which I'm inclined that it is not mythos. I believe there's lots of truth there. In fact, I believe it is the truth. And so supernatural events have literally shaped the world. I mean, we are living the current political landscape, what we see in the world, specifically in the Middle East, what's happening globally is in direct correlation to those events. Our worldview in the United States has been shaped by those supernatural events. Here's some other supernatural events that happened. This guy Jesus running around and it supposedly healing 10 lepers, telling one of his disciples to go and pay the taxes by going down to the sea, catching the first fish, and in the fish's mouth are two gold coins. I mean, that's bizarre. I mean, if that happened to you or I mean, we'd sit there with our jaws on the ground. What about, I mean, if it's true, if he actually fed the 5,000, I believe it is. I mean, why would these guys lie? Remember when they wrote this stuff 2,000 years ago, there's no church, there's no cathedral, there's nothing. It's just a bunch of, you know, 10 guys, 12 guys running around with this guy who's, you know, pulling rabbits out of his hat, literally. But if he actually fed the 5,000, I mean, he's manipulating matter.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's bizarre.
Yeah.
If he actually walked on the water, once again, he's like, somehow he's able to manipulate matter and energy. If he, let's say, cast out a demon or many demons from certain people, once again, he's showing some sort of a power, a greater power than the demon or the satanic force that's in that person.
Wouldn't you hate to think that he was a great illusionist like Chris Angel? I mean, isn't Chris Angel doing many of those same things?
Well, Chris Angel is, but it's all, I've got a little bit of inside stuff there. It's all
magic.
It's all staged. I mean, they have, you know, you're really not there and the camera shows one thing and then you pan the camera over to something else, but it's they're great illusions, and of course, look, you and I can't go back there, you know. I mean, I wish we could. I mean, I really do wish.
Let's get in our time machine and do it.
Well, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
But I believe he's left a calling card.
And what was that?
Well, I believe it's the Shroud of Turin. I've been delving into that lately and spoke to a researcher who's actually researched it and worked on the Shroud for almost 30 years. And there's something that's so enigmatic about the Shroud. And let me say this right off to your listeners, that some people, a lot of skeptics will go, oh, the carbon-14. Well, in 2005, they actually did tests and they realized that where they took the sample from the Shroud, the carbon dated, was from a place where the fire had been the Shroud.
Right.
And it was weaved in. And what's really bizarre, they're end-to-end splices. It's done so cleverly. They're end-to-end splices in the thread. So the carbon dating was from the Riwi, which was done in the 15th century. But here's what's bizarre about the Shroud. It's a two-dimensional image, but it's a holograph. And if you just take part of the Shroud, and this is what this one scientist did, he actually had small samples, fibrils of a cloth. And just from the one fibril, he was able to create the entire holographic image of the cloth. Here's something else. When you look at the cloth and you photograph it, the blood stains cover the arms. All right, so you don't see the full arms even when you take a photograph of it. The arms don't show because the blood stains cover it. Excuse me. And yet when you do the holograph of it, the blood stains aren't there and the arms show perfectly. And it's like, you know, you look at that and you got to say to yourself, you know, whatever happened. And I believe it was a very slow dematerialization of the body within the Shroud. And at the time that happened, the body was probably levitated 6 inches off that slab. The Shroud was pulled tight somehow. Mm-hmm. The body dematerialized, leaving millions of simultaneous points of light, which then impregnated the Shroud.
And do you think this was done on purpose, this calling card?
I'd like to think so. It doesn't, in other words, my faith isn't based on the Shroud of Turin, okay? But what I love about it is, you know, I'm a 21st century guy too, and I like technology. And the Shroud seems to point to the event in a way that it's like a science that we don't even understand yet. I mean, it's actually beyond quantum physics.
Well, we don't even know how the pyramids were built yet.
I agree.
I mean, even with this incredible science that we do possess today, we can't figure these things out from the ancients. I mean, you know, I'm convinced, for example, you talk about in the end times that there's going to be some kind of a nuclear holocaust here. I think we've had that before. I think past civilizations might have had that kind of technology, and they used it on each other.
Well, it's possible. In the Mahabharata, it speaks of that. And
yes.
It talks of a nuclear, it sounds like a nuclear exchange. And, you know, I mean, we only go back so far, and then the trail becomes very dark, very cloudy, and it's all speculation. You know, you mentioned the pyramid. I personally believe, and I write about it in the new book, Politics, Prophecy, and Supernatural, but I believe that the Nephilim, that these guys may have been Goliath, let's say, let me jump ahead of a little bit. Goliath probably was about 12 feet tall. That's a pretty big guy. But what if, and that's the second incursion. In other words, that's thousands and thousands of years probably after the flood, and it's the second incursion. But what about if these guys were 25 to 30 feet tall?
I was going to say, weren't the Nephilim the giants who were supposed to have been wiped out in the flood?
Well, that's the deal, isn't it? And that begs the question, if they manifest the first time, and then we see them manifesting the second time, what's the thing that keeps them from manifesting, and will they manifest again? In other words, there seems like a portal that's open. You know, David Flynn has written a great paper on this whole thing with the idea that when the Book of Enoch, when they touch down on Mount Hermon, if you go to the opposite side of the globe, you wind up in Roswell, New Mexico.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean,
yeah.
To me,
is that weird?
That's just stunning. I mean,
yeah.
That's just an unbelievable discovery, and I would encourage people to check out, you know, Flynn's website.
All right, but you're saying if they were 25 feet tall, you think it would have been easier to move blocks to build the pyramid?
I mean, can you imagine, I mean, the whole idea with Zavi Hawass and others of his ilk, you know, throw up, you know, the idea of ramps and sand and stone and all that. All that, you know, is a possibility, I suppose, and yet it's really never been proven. I mean, I've seen stuff on the History Channel, National Geographic, but in the new book, I get into one specific place which really defies all those theories, and that's Baalbek. And in Baalbek, which is in Lebanon, There are literally the three largest stones ever hewn. And the largest stone is about a quarter mile away, still in the quarry. I mean, this thing is just, it's like...
It's one slab, isn't it?
One slab of stone. And it begs the question, how the heck did these guys move it?
Yeah.
And there's no place for ramps and pulleys and horses or, you know, elephants or any of this stuff. But can you imagine if you had a group of giants 20, 25, 30 feet tall? I mean, all of a sudden...
Oh, how many would you need, though? A couple hundred of them?
And I believe there were a lot more than a couple hundred of these guys running around.
Where are the bones, though?
Well, some of the bones have been found. Dr. I.D.E. Thomas, in his book, The Omega Conspiracy, cites giant bones being found. I know Dan Quayle is extensively researched.
Steve Quayle.
See, I'm sorry.
Dan's the old vice president.
Nice little slip there.
That's right.
There you go, thanks. You know, Steve Quayle's dealt with...
Most of the time I don't catch him. I just nod.
Nod and smile, knowingly. But, you know, Quayle's delved into that, and I believe, and I'm actually starting some research on this and kind of nosed around. Last time I was on, this is like an apocryphal story, and this is kind of interesting and should pique some of the interest of your listeners, hopefully anyway. I had this very enigmatic email from someone. Now, there's no way I can prove this. I mean, I really tried to get to the source. I begged, I pleaded, I cajoled, I wrote nice, happy little friendly emails, and the person apparently that had experienced this would not come on the record with me. It was always through an intermediary, and it was email to email, and then I would wait a couple of days and I would get an email, that type of thing. So I have no idea whether this is true or not, but the story goes like this. About a decade ago, I believe it's in New Mexico, there's this flash flood. This person in question, whether it was a male or female, I don't even know that. I know nothing about the source. But there was this flash flood that happened, and this ancient burial ground, which had never been discovered, was all of a sudden exposed. And in the graveyard were skeletons of giants with red hair. And some of them, according to this witness, had six fingers, six toes, sounds like in the film. And these skeletons were between 9 and 12 feet tall. Now, according to the source, I can't prove this. Again, this is all hearsay. It might just be a great yarn. But according to the source, the Smithsonian came in, boxed this stuff up, made everybody sign, you know, non-disclosure contract type things, and carted them off. And that was the end of it. And I know from, you know, discussing and just reading, been on the net and talking to different people, it seems like when the settlers pushed west, and they uncovered mounds, there were many skeletons like this that were found, which really don't fit. It just doesn't really fit with the whole idea of the land bridge and the American Indian. I mean, these skeletons are like, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 feet tall, red hair, you know, the six digits on the fingers and toes. And I've got several friends who ancestors were Native Americans. And I think last time we discussed this briefly, but they said that the whole idea, you know, the Hollywood, when the Indian goes how and raises his hand, what that was for, now this is from two separate sources who were Native Americans, descendants from Native Americans, that when they would raise their hand, it was to show that they didn't have the six digit on the finger.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, real interesting. And so the presence of the Nephilim were in the United States, which of course... I mean, that doesn't figure into Darwinism. It doesn't figure into the, you know, the Alaskan land bridge. I mean, it doesn't figure into anything. And I believe that, you know, these guys were around, and for some reason they seem to manifest, and then the portal is closed for whatever reason. I'm not sure how that mechanism works. I believe the portal may have been opened again. You know, I get into that in the book in great detail with Nazi Germany and World War II and what the Holocaust was, what the whole word Holocaust means as a burnt offering, as an altar. To me, these guys were Luciferians. They were satanic adepts, if you will. Not all of them.
Might have been, though.
Were.
Might have been. Absolutely. And then, well, this evolution then that went from 25 feet to 12 feet, Goliath, did it stay that way for a long time?
I think that progressively, for whatever reason, the power seems to be waning on some level. And it's like the first incursion with the fallen angels, they were, for whatever reason, there was a lot of power. There was a lot of power with the genetics. The second incursion, it's less. The height is less. you know, Goliath was a mighty man, but, you know, David apparently was able to slay him.
Hit him in the right spot. We'll be back in a moment. Prophecy, the supernatural. He's ties in Mothman as well. Get ready to go. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're giving away a free CD. You just pay a nominal shipping and handling cost with it. But it is a classic Art Bell interview with Al Bielek from the Philadelphia Experiment. When you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter or renew, call 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com and get this classic interview. It is something else. And I just want you to know that Al Bielek has come on some hard times, and that's why we're doing it with this CD. We're giving him a cash donation with every sale here of one of those subscriptions. So first time we've ever done that, and we probably won't do it again, but we're doing this for Mr. Al Bielek. So call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And we're with L.A. Marzulli, his latest book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. Lynn, the Anunnaki, could they be the same as the Nephilim, the Anunnaki, of course, the ones that Zechariah Sitchin points out in his Sumerian works, coming from another planet, Planet X?
Right. The only, again, you know, that that's like a $64,000 loaded question. Basically, where I'm at with that is, I do respect his work, and I can appreciate it, and I understand it. I draw from... to me, that's more mythos. I mean, I think it's based in some fact, but I think the true deal, the real deal, it can be found in the Genesis account, and also, of course, the Book of Enoch. It also can be found in Josephus's references to the Nephilim, at the bones of the Nephilim that were very large were in Jerusalem at the time of his writing, which means the first century. So, I mean, that's where I put it together, and that's kind of what I kind of believe in. I just think that's it's, in other words, like you know, he's looking at that, he's interpreting what he's seeing from a snapshot in time, where the stories that I'm looking to are not only based let's say in each individual story, but there seems to be a prophetic thread that runs through them, and the prophetic thread is told by different authors over a period of thousands of years, where the whole Anunnaki or Anunnaki, you know, legend or mythos is kind of stuck in one time frame, like Nostradamus. It's just stuck in one century, whereas, you know, the Hebrew scriptures, the ancient texts that I explore, specifically the Bible, those ancient prophetic texts have that commonality, a thread, and yet there's no collusion between the authors, and in fact, in many cases, there's centuries separating the authors, and yet they pick up. So it begs the question: who or what is outside our time-space continuum, and letting these guys know the future? And the prophecy, in my opinion, has to be 100% accurate, 100% of the time. So, with all respect to Sitchin's work, I don't see that thread of prophecy in there. I see a story. Which, I can't prove or disprove, neither can he. Whereas with this, the biblical model, let's say, there's that thread of prophecy, and we see prophecy not only being fulfilled thousands of years ago, but being fulfilled right in our lifetime, which to me is just, really bizarre.
I was going to say, why do you seem to rely a lot on ancient prophetic texts? What's the tie-in there for prophecy?
The tie-in basically is there seems to be a window where this stuff was written down, period of about 2,000 to 3,000 years, and the Hebrew scriptures were put together. And I realize some people go, the Council of Nicaea, everything was changed around, which is just total nonsense. If you really, really study it and understand what happened, it's not what the Council of Nicaea was about. But that's a sidebar. But the reason why I put such importance in these, for instance, I mentioned a few minutes ago the fact that ancient prophecy being fulfilled in our lifetime. Here's one that's written about 2,000 years ago. It says specifically, Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So you say, well, that's interesting. What does that mean? When it was written 2,000 years ago, Israel was under Roman domination.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the Gentiles.
Exactly. But Israel was still there in the homeland. It was still, even though they were ruled by Rome, It was the Temple Mount was theirs, and the ancient homeland of Israel was basically intact till AD 70, when Titus rolls in and destroys the thing, killing upwards of 1 million people, and dispersing the Jews throughout, you know, Europe and every place else in the ancient world known as the diaspora.
That's when it all started,
right? That's when it starts. Yep. That's when the clock ticks. And the clock ticks basically for 2,000 years, almost 2,000 years, until 1948, when the State of Israel is regathered, which fulfills, by the way, it's like, it's funny, it fulfills that prophecy in a sense there. But the prophecy that it also fulfills is Ezekiel 37, which talks about, I mean, this stuff is really very specific and very poignant. It says very specifically that in the end days, the latter days, that the nation, that the Jews, the nation of Israel, will be regathered from the four corners of the earth, from the nations of the world, and brought back into their homeland. I mean, that in itself, I mean, it has to make you stop and go, okay, if it's real, and we know it's real because we point to 1948, then, you know, who or what seems to be outside our space-time domain? And is whatever this thing is, is it benevolent or malevolent? Can I trust it? And so, you know, that fulfills part of the scripture. But the other fulfillment of that prophecy is Jerusalem will be trampled on the Gentiles. That doesn't happen until, I believe, the 65 war, when the Israelis go in and they reclaim the Temple Mount. In other words, they go in and retake the old city.
I see, okay.
Then Jerusalem is no longer, you know, trodden down by the Gentiles. So the prophecy is completely fulfilled.
Was there any time in the history of the text where these events could have been interpreted as occurring thousands of years ago? I think not, right?
Well, I would say, and I would vote, of course, that, you know, that it hasn't been. There is a movement within, you know, certain circles, or called preterists, that believe that the entire book of Revelation has already happened. And yet, you know, when you start ticking off the, you know, the points, I think it's kind of like a straw man argument. It just falls of its own weight eventually. So I certainly don't believe that, and I believe that many of the prophecies that are still unfulfilled. For instance, the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. I mean, you know, when we say those things, it's like, I mean, it's written there, and I believe that temple will be rebuilt. Of course, you know, it's not going to happen anytime soon, at least the way the situation is over there right now.
Now, so if these prophecies are correct, what does it lead to, Lynn? Where are we headed?
I believe that history is not cyclical like Toynbee. I don't believe that we're here and this thing just endlessly rolls on. I believe that it's climactic, and I believe that it's kind of like a score in an orchestra, or, you know, an orchestral score where that's, you know, finally the orchestra is crescendoing into something, and it's like it resolves. And I think that's kind of where the world is headed. In the book, you know, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, the political part of the book, without really getting into it here, and if your readers are interested, you know, pick up the book. I really, really get into it in the book. But the bottom line is, it seems like things are really heating up globally. There seems to be a tension globally that's not going away. And, you know, if, let's say, for instance, if certain countries in the Middle East wind up with a nuke, will they use it? And if, of course, they do, you know, I believe it's headed towards some sort of a, and you got to remember that Ezekiel 38-39 fulfillment of that prophecy is not the Battle of Armageddon. It's not the Battle of Armageddon. And it's interesting enough, it says in another one of the scriptures, another one of the ancient prophecies 2,000 years ago, it talks about that in the latter days that Lucifer, our old buddy again, comes back.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does, he comes with all signs and lying wonders so that even the elect would be deceived. So it's like, it's a very complex mix. I believe that it, you know, the battle in Ezekiel 38 and 39, which happens in Israel, it's a confederacy of nations which attack Israel, all right? Interestingly enough, Iraq is not one of them, but Iran is the second one listed. So that should just stun everybody. You know, this thing is written like 2,500 years ago.
Yeah, and here it is. It's like it's unfolding right under our eyes.
I mean, I follow this stuff daily. I do. And the saber rattling over there has been insane lately. And, you know, it's like, is this the Ezekiel 38 and 39 war? I don't know, but it sure looks like it. To me, it looks like the stage is being set. I can only look at the text, see what it says. You know, the first one on the list is called, you know, Gog Magog. So who is that? There's dispute. It could be Turkey. A lot of Bible scholars believe it's the, you know, what would be Russia today's.
Russia, China, maybe?
I don't think it's China, but I think it's more Russia.
Okay.
Especially when you see what Putin has sold into the, you know, given to the Iranians recently. So it's like there seems to be this nice little confederacy that's forming against this nation of unwalled villages. Again, you know, that's in the text of Ezekiel 38. When that prophecy was penned 2,500 years ago, there was no such thing as a land of unwalled villages. It just didn't exist. I mean, the first thing you did if you had a city was build the highest, thickest wall you could possibly build to keep out invaders from taking your crops, your cattle, raping your women, and killing your children or whatever. So that's what you did. And so the fact that the prophet seeing this thing 2,500 years ago, he writes in the land of unwalled villages, and that, of course, that's what, you know, modern warfare is. Modern Israel is a land of unwalled villages, literally. And it comes up against, you know, this confederacy of nation comes up against this land of unwalled villages, and then it describes, in my opinion, and I really, really detail this in the book, what I believe is a nuclear exchange, specifically a neutron bomb or several neutron bombs dropped by the Israelis because they have no choice at this point. Now, that's a horrifying scenario.
It is.
And I pray it doesn't happen. I mean, I'm not sitting here going, oh, boy, I hope this happens.
No, I understand that.
It's just, it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. And yet, you know, we all have free will. And as we can see, you know, when you get leaders in countries saying that Israel should be annihilated and wiped off the map, or Israel is a withered tree soon to be plucked up by its roots, these are statements that are incredibly vitriolic, and there's not much wiggle room in these statements. And so, you know, I think that it's heading towards this point. It's like a flash point. It's not Armageddon. It's a precursor to it. And I believe it's the Ezekiel 38-39 war. But as we can see happening, to move into the supernatural here, you know, that's like the political and the prophetic angle. Like the politics are happening, and they're you know, the politics are, we're looking at this thing spiraling out of control, and most of it has been set in motion thousands of years ago by supernatural events that started these religions, all right? So now we look at the prophetic actually happening. We see that Ezekiel 38, 39, the stage may be set for that, and then we move into supernatural. What do we got? We've got the crop circle in England a couple of weeks ago, where the film crew staked out that crop circle.
We had a full report on that. Incredible. And it was made within 90 minutes.
Unbelievable. You know, and it's like, of course, the Stepniks are going to go, it's a bunch of guys with boards and string. And, sorry, wrong.
All right, how does that tie into prophecy?
I'm sorry, what was that?
How does that tie into prophecy, crop circles?
Well, again, I think it's part of the end game. I think it's part of a deception. I lump, you know, the crop circles and many of these supernatural events all together. In other words, to me, it has one source. Cattle mutilations, crop circles, all the UFO stuff, Mothman, you know, apparitions, you know, spooky stuff that's going on. It's all tied into one thing. It's all from the same source. It's all from the same source. And I believe that source is incredibly malevolent and is trying to manifest this one world leader. That's their end game. The Luciferian end game is to manifest essentially the Antichrist. And I believe the Antichrist will be in the Phelim. It'll be a genetic hybrid that'll look and appear very human, but nonetheless will be essentially a part fallen angel. You know, getting back right before the break, you said, you know, why the first outbreak of a Nephilim may have been 20, 25, 30 feet tall. Goliath is less and less and less.
Yeah.
You know, many of the abductees, when they tell their story, they talk about the children that they see. They're very sickly looking. They don't look well. And then as time goes on, you know, it seems like the batch that follows them, if I can use that word, you know, the next generation seem to be healthier and more human-like. So this, of course, ties in with my theory that the fallen angels have actually gotten weaker through millennia. Why? I don't know that. I don't have the answer to that. But they don't have the same power that they had in the first incursion.
Maybe they're more human.
Well, I don't think fallen angels can. I think they can shapeshift and look like human, but I think they're different than we are, completely different.
Didn't they breed with humans?
Well, they do.
Yeah.
They did and probably still do.
That's what I mean. Maybe the offshoot, the offspring, they're just not as genetically strong as the others.
Good question.
I want to talk a lot about supernatural when we get into next hour, but what's the timetable? If you think these things are occurring, when does the hammer really come down, Lynn?
Well, again, I'm not. I can't set a date. I can't set a time. I mean, it'd be foolish to do so. I can only tell you that, in my opinion, I think we're close. If I dare use his name, Ahmadinejad has threatened recently that, you know, there's going to be a war in the region this summer. So we're in the end of July. We're moving into August. So, you know, last summer we saw a regional war, and that, you know, that to me, that this is the trigger. When we see Ezekiel 38 and 39, and it just can't be like the little excursion, you know, last summer between Hezbollah and Israel. I mean, that's a skirmish. That's not what I'm talking about.
No, you're talking about
the real deal.
Yeah,
the real deal. When they have no alternative except to use the neutron bomb.
So you think the use of that bomb is desperation?
I think it's desperation, and I think the Israelis are not going to be pushed back into the sea, and they're not going to be overrun.
And they're not going to lose.
They're not going to lose. But when that happens, I believe it triggers some of the supernatural to begin to manifest on the earth.
And they also won't take a lot of collateral damage.
I don't think they will. No. I don't think they will.
No, it's not going to have, you know, like during the first Iraq war when the, Scud missiles were launched.
Right.
That's not going to happen again.
No, this time it's in fact, the prophecy was interesting, says that the collective force that's gathered up against Israel is decimated. In other words, 5/6 of the army is completely destroyed. And here's something really bizarre on that. I mean, this is 2,500 years ago. I mean, this stuff is bizarre.
Well, then let me ask you this, too. Do you think world leaders look at Revelation and they say, okay, we need to do this, we need to do this, and they're looking at it like a playbook?
You know, I've heard that you know, people have said, well, this whole thing is being manipulated. But I mean, how do you manipulate, you know, other countries, let's say, that are involved, that have such vitriol against the nation of Israel?
Unless they're all in collusion with each other, you know.
But they are. But they don't know. They're not aware of our eschatology or these prophecies. Most of them aren't. I mean, Ahmadinejad believes in the manifestation of the 12th Imam. That's what he's waiting for.
True, but I think he's probably a pretty good scholar of the Bible.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be. I haven't sat down with him recently, so I don't know. That'd be a very interesting conversation.
I mean, they know. And before they started going into their offshoots, they all believed generally in the same thing, didn't they?
Well, somewhat.
Yep.
You know, I mean, there's certain roots in... and I don't want to really, you know, hop into that. I'm not an Islamic scholar.
No.
Yeah, but I mean, there's some similarities. But I mean, they're just, again, it's one person over one small period of time. Whereas the other, you know, Hebrew Christian Bible is this, you know, 4,000-year-old event that's, you know, no collusion between the authors, and yet there seems to be a thread that runs all the way through them. So that's why I keep going back to that, as there seems to be real amazing validity, and the prophecies seem to be unfolding one after the other, you know. And it's the fact that Israel was in the homeland and you know, the land of unwalled villages, and the times of the Gentiles is now over in Jerusalem. I mean, all those things are prophecies written thousands of years ago happening in our lifetime. So getting back to the question of the trigger, I think it's soon. You know, does that mean a year? Could it be this summer? It could be this summer. I mean, it's heating up. You know, the stage is set for it. It certainly could happen this summer. Certainly could happen this summer. I mean, I hope it doesn't. But, you know, from that, I think it triggers the supernatural. And that, to me, and of course, I document the whole Fatima apparitions, and I realize that that's like, you know, kicking over a hornet's nest to some people, because some people look at the Fatima apparitions as the real thing. And of course, I have a completely different take on it. And when you interview the witnesses or people who have been able to go back and search out the documents, it doesn't seem like it's the miracle of the sun. It seems more like the miracle of a silver disc that's spinning.
Okay, you tie this into the subtitle of the book, The Coming Great Deception in the Luciferian Endgame. You believe that all this is being done as what? An illusion in order to find the Antichrist?
Yeah, I think the endgame is basically to herald the rule of this one particular person that's called the Antichrist. And here's something to ponder and think about. Once again, the prophecies say that there'll be a one-world government, a one-world religious system. How the heck are you going to get everybody to change their worldview unless something so unbelievable happens? And that what's the one event that's manifesting? Granted, it's always like the Phoenix Lights, you know, it's seen by thousands of people, but you know, nobody can really prove it, and the photography's sketchy, and the skeptics have a field day with it. But you know, the people who saw it, including the former governor, you know, on the Larry King show, I saw that, by the way, it was a great show. I mean, he apologized to his constituents and said, "Hey, I was there and I saw it. It wasn't of this world." You know, so I mean, this stuff is manifesting, and what, you know, that's all supernatural stuff. And so I believe that this, you know, it's ramping up to this deception. And when this thing, when full alien disclosure happens, everyone's worldview will change. I mean, it will just change. And I believe that they'll have sort of visual aids to help us over the hump, so to speak.
All right, Ali, stay with us because we'll talk about the supernatural portion of your work next on Coast to Coast AM.